Life could change on a dime if you made a choice, if you let yourself have what you wanted. The cry came again. It clawed through my thoughts, reeled me back to reality. It was louder now, much louder. It was coming from inside the house. So much blood. For an instant, I stood paralyzed. That sound had not come from a bird or any other animal. It came from somewhere in the basement, but all the bedrooms were on the first floor. Why would my mom or Aaron be in the basement at this time of night? A more important question, why would either of them make that sound? That desperate, wordless plea of suffering. Someone in terrible pain. Someone who needed help. I heard something else then, and it made my heart beat so hard I thought it might crack my ribs. Heavy footfalls from above. Clumping. Stomping. Neither my mom nor Aaron could make that much noise walking around if they tried. That meant there was someone else in the house. Someone big. Someone who wasn't supposed to be here. The mystery truck parked at the end of the drive. Cell phone. Police. My brain merged these three elements and a plan was born. Call the freaking cops. Don't wait to find out if it's all a misunderstanding. Do it now. I forced my joints to bend and reached into my bag, fumbling for my phone. My fingers found my inhaler and moved on. My lungs were tight, my airway cinching closed, but this was no time for an asthma attack. Upstairs, someone stomped around the kitchen, making no effort to be quiet. What did that mean? Oh, God, what did that mean? My mom. Aaron. One of them had made the sound. The cry. A sob welled in my throat, and I smothered it with one hand, while the other, shaking uncontrollably, dialed 911. Keep it together, I commanded myself as I waited for the ringing to begin. Stay calm, make sense, be coherent for the operator. My eyes were hot and tight with the pressure of tears, and every sound made my nerves snap. 911, what's your emergency? A woman's voice answered. She sounded brisk, alert. I opened my mouth and heard a thin wheeze of a response. There's someone in my house. I think he... Say it. I think he might have done something to my family. I think he... hurt them. Saying the words aloud made me shake even harder, but the operator was all business. I'm going to send officers out to you right away, miss. Tell me your address. For a moment, my mind went blank. What was my address? What the hell was my address? The answer landed in my head and I blurted it out, too loud. I went still, listened. No movement upstairs. A creak from above. A cupboard door opening. He was looking through our kitchen cupboards. Miss, the operator was saying. Miss, officers are en route. Are you in a safe place?
He doesn't know I'm here, I said.
Okay, that's good. Stay where you are. The cry came again, and this time I pinpointed its origin, the north end of the basement, where the only semi-finished room was located. Mom used the room for storage. It was the only one with walls and a door. The cry came again, weaker now and more desperate at the same time. I recognized the voice. Aaron. I couldn't wait for the cops. I had to get to her. Miss, the operator said. Miss, what's happening now? More sounds from above. Wooden chair legs scraping across tile. He was sitting down at the kitchen table, making himself comfortable. What was he eating? Mom had made lasagna yesterday. There were plenty of leftovers. He had probably helped himself. Rage churned inside me. It battled with my terror until the two joined and filled me with a chaos of emotions that made it impossible to think straight. Miss, are you there? What's happening?
I have to go, I said and hung up.
I silenced the cell in case the operator tried to call back and shoved it into my pocket. Then I was moving. There was no light. I walked softly, but every step I took nearly gave me a heart attack. I was sweating ice water and shivering, and I couldn't see a thing. I bolted silently across the remaining distance, but slipped and fell when I was almost there.
I touched the ground and felt sticky wetness. Please don't be blood, I thought. Please don't be blood.
Then my fingers found something else. I picked up the fragile object. A quick exploration with my fingers told me what it was. A pair of eyeglasses. The lenses shattered. Bile rose in my throat. I wiped my hands on my jeans and pushed to my feet. The sounds from upstairs had stopped, but I imagined I could hear the man chewing. In my head, the sound was as loud as his stomping footsteps, the gooey, wet smacking and gnashing of teeth. I stole the rest of the way to the north end of the basement. The door to the storage room was closed, and there was light coming from beneath. I leaned with my ear close to the crack, straining to hear through the wood. A girl's shuddering whimper penetrated the barrier. I opened the door. The bare bulb glaring above cast a mean, relentless light over everything, over the lake of blood that swamped the concrete floor. My mom was propped against the wall like a forgotten doll on a shelf, her head lolling forward, her white nightgown drenched red with blood. I couldn't tell if she was breathing.
Kenna?
The voice was barely a voice. It was a wheeze, a thready gasp. Aaron lay crumpled in the corner of the room. I skirted around the blood and dropped painfully to my knees beside her. Suffocated sobs tore at my throat. Aaron's face was a disfigured purple landscape, one of her eyes a swollen mound sealed with a crust of blood. Her pajamas, too, were soaked in blood. My hands hovered over her, wanting to help, unsure what to do or if there was anything I could do. She needed medical attention and fast. She was so small, so delicate. It was a miracle she was still alive. How long until the police came? How long did my sister have? Minutes? Seconds? Aaron opened her mouth and tried to speak again. Blood gurgled in her throat. Shh, don't talk, I said, my chest so tight I could barely produce the words. Help is coming, I called the police. But we lived so far from town. It took Blake and me 20 minutes to drive to school every morning. How much time had passed since I'd called 911? 5 minutes? 3? I should call again. Tell them to send an ambulance. I reached for my phone. Aaron's eye rolled toward me.
Get out, she managed. He wants you.
The man upstairs started moving again, and this time his footsteps were tromping down the stairs. Aaron's one eye went wide, and she started breathing fast, but her lungs couldn't handle the air, and she started choking until blood speckled her lips. He was coming. There was no way for me to get back to my hiding place, to get anywhere, before he blocked me in. I rushed to the door, closed it, and locked it. I spun around, searching for something to prop against the door. I went for a chest of drawers painted butter yellow, which had been mine when I was a kid. As I shoved it in front of the door, it made a shrieking sound across the concrete. The footsteps halted for one deafeningly silent moment, then thundered as he ran. I got the chest of drawers in front of the door just as the man twisted the knob. When it refused to turn, he pounded the door. I backed away, my heart thrashing. My vision darkened around the edges with every rapid thud. I retreated to where Aaron lay and huddled beside her. Every time the man struck the door, my whole body jolted and my teeth ground together like I'd received an electric shock.
He won't get in. The cops will be here soon. Don't worry. Don't worry.
I wasn't sure if I was talking to Aaron or to myself. I checked her face to see if she was even conscious, and a moan escaped my throat. Aaron was limp, lifeless. A memory burned behind my eyes, a butterfly gone slack, sagging to the bottom of a glass jar. My moan became a wail, a banshee shriek of grief. I pulled Aaron into my arms and crushed her against me. My sister, my broken twin self, my best friend. Gone. The pounding ceased, and then something worse followed. The man on the other side of the door began to laugh. Lights out. My wail and the man's laughter collided, making a horrible, discordant sound. I clamped my mouth shut, but my chest strained, filling up with unvoiced anguish. Something was sure to pop, to tear apart inside me. A lung, a heart. The man finally stopped laughing.
"It's about time you came home, Kenna. I thought you might keep me waiting all night."
I rocked my sister's body, holding her so tight I would have hurt her if she were alive. I tried to speak. I wanted to scream that the police were on their way, that he'd better get out while he could. But I opened my mouth and all that came out was a silent, hissing scream. My chest was on fire. My body, my skin and bones, tingled like a limb coming back to life.
"Are you wondering why?" the man said. "Why your house, your family? I came for you, Kenna."
His voice lowered, so I had to strain to hear him.
"I've been watching you for a while now. I wanted to know who you were, to understand why you would kill an innocent little boy."
My breath stopped in my throat. I remembered the man in the crowd who'd stood there glaring at me with such hatred. There was only one person in the world who had a reason to look at me like that. Thomas Dunn.
"My son, my perfect little boy."
He pounded his fist against the door, and a strangled sob wrenched from his throat.
"You stole him from me."
A scream loosed from my throat.
"Get out of my house."
A sizzling burn swept across my skin. I felt as though I were coming apart, like filaments of me were peeling away, threads of flesh reaching out from my body and waving in the air, the tips ending in raw, tender nerves.
"Open the door, Kenna. It's time you paid for what you took."
I shivered so hard my teeth made a sound in my head like helicopter blades cutting the air. I moaned and buried my face in my sister's hair. There was blood in it, already starting to coagulate, turning her thin strands into stiff, tacky dreadlocks. It was my fault. All of this was my fault. The image of the dying butterfly flashed behind my eyes again, the shattering glass of its prison. Jason Dunn's empty eyes sinking into their sockets, his face turning gray, his skin shrinking against his skull. The butterfly's wings tensing, batting, lifting it into the sky.
"Open the door, you murderer!"
He struck the door and a crack formed. I didn't know how much time had passed since the 911 operator told me the police were on their way, but I didn't think they were going to make it in time. I gathered Erin in my arms and lifted her. She was so light she seemed to float into the air, resting weightlessly in the crooks of my elbows. The sound of the door splintering was far away now. Numbness filled my ears like cotton. My fingertips burned as though I'd been handling hot coals. My entire body felt like one prickling nerve ending, those strings of me that had unraveled continuing to quiver and dance above my skin. I felt like an electric sea creature, lightning made flesh. I laid Aaron's body down over my mom's outstretched legs, and then I burrowed in against them, dipping myself into their cooling blood. I didn't feel revolted. The only thing I felt was all-consuming grief and the tingling extension of my skin. The room seemed brighter than it ought to be. The bare bulb overhead radiated an intense white light, almost too dazzling to look at. It grew brighter and brighter and then began to flicker for a moment. And right before it popped, I thought once more of the butterfly careening drunkenly into the sky. The light bulb exploded, and shards of thin glass rained down from the ceiling. Everything shook. But the room did not go dark. The blinding white light remained, but 100 new hues had joined it. Swirling mists of green, blue, lavender, sparks of yellow and flickers of red and orange in the air, like ghosts made of fire. A storm of light and color, bubbling and blossoming and fogging around me. I saw them now. The strands of light stretched from my body, an expanding network of colored electricity, reaching through the door, the walls. A mushrooming matrix of luminous, hair-thin ribbons. Everything was quaking, and I was so hot and so cold, and my eyes ached from the light and vibrant color that condensed and billowed toward me like a gathering storm. A violent aurora borealis trapped in this tiny room. I tangled my arms with my mom's and Aaron's limbs, so I was touching them, no longer afraid to hurt them, Those veins of light extending off me seem to pierce my family's skin and connect us, creating one organism. Then something new. A vacuuming sensation at the tips of the strands, like they'd all become minuscule whirlpools, and I was filling up inside. Elation fluttered my heart. Joy. Madness. A ferocious euphoria, and it was so wrong. So wrong to feel this way right now, but I couldn't help it. Whatever was happening was beyond my control. My emotions flashed from rage to hunger, from buzzing excitement to terror, from yearning to passion, to feverish arousal, to a predatory desire to hunt, kill, and taste blood in my mouth, to poison, to bite. The urges kept coming, shifting faster. The impulse to cower, to protect, to run, to fly. It was too much, too much. I was drowning in impulse and color and light. So much light. Then the room began to darken little by little, light and color washing from the air like night overtaking a sunset. I was so overwhelmed, so mesmerized by what was happening, that I didn't realize the pounding on the door had stopped. The mayhem inside me reached critical mass, and I felt like I would explode if I didn't release it. The vacuuming sensation reversed, and all that joy and exultation and wildness rushed through the strands connecting me to my mom and Aaron, strained by colored tubes as thin and strong as spider silk, until every mad, euphoric sensation was gone. I cried out as the colored strands vanished from sight. I'd lost the light again, and I was empty. The light and color were gone. The maelstrom in my head and heart were gone. I felt as though I'd gone blind and deaf. Then something stirred against my hand. The stirring became a spastic flutter of flesh. In the dark, I screamed. I struggled to my feet, caught in legs and limbs. I forgot about the blood. My feet skidded out from under me, and for a moment I was midair, tilting upside down. Then my skull hit the concrete floor, and the darkness got darker. Before I blacked out, I saw a figure lurching through the darkness. Thomas Dunn was inside the room then. So he would be the last thing I saw. I suppose that was what I deserved. Impossible. Wake up, Kenna. Wake up. A woman's familiar voice. Is she okay? Mom, is she okay? This time, the voice came from a girl. I don't know. She's breathing. I think she might have hit her head. Kenna? Kenna! My lids peeled open over my eyes, and pain boomed in my skull, a sledgehammer blow that made firecrackers explode in my vision. Darkness and sparks. Darkness and sparks. But this pain was nothing compared to the hollowness inside me, a vacant feeling like some vital organ had been removed. Mom? Aaron? I said in a tearful moan. Had I followed them into death? I'd never subscribed to any particular belief about the afterlife, but this was not my kind of heaven, not this dark place. I was cold and empty and wet, as though I was still in the basement, soaked in blood. I sat up fast, blinking out the shadows and the skull-splitting pyrotechnics. The pain in my head blossomed, but my vision began to clear and my eyes to adjust. A narrow bar of moonlight shone under the door, enough light for me to recognize I was in the storage room, and there were two people in the room with me. Two people who were kneeling on the other side of me in their own blood, and neither of them was Thomas Dunn. My mom and Aaron, alive. Impossible. My memory reversed, and I saw the moments before I blacked out. A figure staggering through the darkness, the phantom lights that came from everywhere and nowhere, filling me to bursting and then vacuumed out of me, cracking me open as they left. The bulb overhead bursting, showering slivers of glass. Thomas Dunn hammering at the door, and then silence. He'd stopped trying to get in, perhaps startled by the light in the room, if that had even been real. Was he still out there, lying in wait to finish what he'd started, what I'd started when I took his son's life? My eyes, adjusting to the darkness now, scoured my family. Despite my aversion to physical contact, I reached out with a trembling hand and touched my mom. She was warm. I sensed the force of her vitality like static electricity, and her eyes were black, pupils expanded to the size of pennies. Why, I didn't know, but who cared? My mom was alive, and so was Aaron. That was all that mattered. I pulled Aaron into a hug, tears burning my eyes, and released her just as quickly. Something about her was different. She felt different. I held her back and studied her face. Both of her eyes were open and black, the same as my mom's. Even though when I'd first seen her in the basement, one of her eyes had been a mound of swelling, the lid sealed shut with blood. "How?" I asked. Mom shook her head, touched the slash marks in her nightgown, as though she were remembering how she got them, who gave them to her. Her head turned toward the splintered door, and her upper lip curled to show her teeth. "Where is he?"
I don't know," I said.
The door was barely a door anymore. If Thomas Dunn had wanted in, he would have been in. Mom rose unsteadily to her feet, her movements disjointed, like those of a newly birthed foal trying to stand for the first time, gawky on unfamiliar legs. She crept in a herky-jerky style toward the door. She peered through the ragged hole he'd made, and then shoved aside the chest of drawers.
"Mom,"
I said sharply, but she turned the knob and wrenched the door open, revealing an unmoving figure lying face down on the floor outside. I saw that Thomas Dunn had a handgun tucked into the back of his pants. Mom bent to grasp Dunn's wrist and check his pulse. I braced myself for him to roar to life suddenly, pull out whatever knife he'd used to slay my family the first time around, and do it all over again. Or maybe this time he would use the gun. There was a brittle, cracking sound, and then Mr. Dunn's arm broke off at the elbow like it was no more than a piece of old charred wood. Aaron screamed and clung to me. I would have screamed too, but I couldn't find my voice. Mom dropped Mr. Dunn's arm, and it hit the concrete, shattering to dust. When Aaron's scream ended, I heard the sound of tires grinding to a halt on our gravel drive outside the house, followed by the upstairs door crashing open and footsteps pounding across the floor. The cavalry had arrived, but I wasn't sure the old better-late-than-never maxim applied this time. There were going to be questions, and as had been the case when I ran from Jason Dunn's lifeless body, I didn't have any answers. Boots thudded down the stairs and flashlight beams cut through the shadows.
"We're over here,"
Mom called to the cops. She raised her hand so they would see she was harmless, but she couldn't seem to hold them still. That herky-jerky wind-up toy jitter continued. The flashlight beams located her and froze long enough for the responding officers to take in the sight of a crazed-looking woman drenched in blood before one of them barked,
"Lie down on the ground."
"This is my house," Mom said. "My daughters and I were attacked, but..."
"Down on the ground," the same cop insisted.
Mom did as she was told, lowering herself to her knees and then lying down flat. Aaron and I did the same. I ended up next to Thomas Dunn's body, looking into his face, and I gasped, even though I knew what I would see. Thomas Dunn looked like he'd been dead for a month, or a year. His skin was lizard gray and leathered, wrapping around the bones of his face and arms. His eyes, black and wrinkled like prunes, had sunk deep into their sockets. The fingers on his remaining arm were curled into raptor claws. Even as I watched, his hair continued to detach from his scalp and shed onto the floor around him. He looked just like Jason had when I'd gotten through with him. The police swarmed us, checking for weapons. When they were assured that we were victims, not the perpetrators, they refocused their attention on the dead man and his kill room. I explained that I'd made the 911 call, and that despite the blood on my clothes, I was unhurt, and let myself be escorted upstairs. My mom and Aaron remained in the basement. The police, assuming they were still injured, chose to restrict their movement. A part of me wanted to stay downstairs with them, to never let them out of my sight again, and at the same time I wanted to distance myself from them, needed to distance myself. I was all too aware of a growing hunger inside me, a gnawing sensation, not in my stomach, but everywhere, in every cell, every pore, in my blood and my brain. This cavernous craving was familiar. I'd felt it 7 years ago when I'd emerged from the forest, the state of euphoria I'd lived in for 2 days having abandoned me, leaving me empty and ravenous. Whatever I'd done to bring Aaron and my mom back from the dead, it had also brought back my hunger. Two cops guided me into the kitchen and requested I stay there. I spotted the plate Thomas Dunn had used, still sitting on the kitchen table. He had indeed helped himself to leftover lasagna. An impressionistic pattern of red sauce and cheese had dried onto the plate. How insane had he become over the years since his son's death that he could massacre a family and then eat comfort food? Maybe cruelty ran in his blood, and he'd passed it down to Jason. Our kitchen had one of those greenhouse-style windows over the sink, all glass, with two shelves where my mom kept an array of houseplants and potted herbs. As I entered the kitchen, I saw that the plants my mom cared for so meticulously had turned the color of ash and drooped in their pots. Some had crumbled like ancient paper. "Did you place the 911 call?" a female officer asked me, striding into the kitchen. She might have been 5'2" on her tiptoes, but she looked to be all muscle under her uniform. She had eyes like a boxer, squinty and darting, the kind of eyes that didn't miss a thing. "I did," I said, still studying the plants. She examined me, taking in my blood-stained clothes. "Are you hurt?" "No," I told her, ignoring the throbbing pain in my head. If I said yes, someone would insist on examining me, and I couldn't have anyone touching me right then. I didn't know what I might do.
"Are you sure?"
"I'm fine," I snarled, my tone so vicious it made the officer take a step back. "I'm sorry. I need my inhaler," I wheezed and bolted past the officer, tore open the kitchen junk drawer and found the inhaler Mom always kept there. Aaron and I used the same one. I didn't have a prescription because the doctor Mom took me to claimed I didn't have asthma, that it was all in my head. I sucked in 3 inhalations of the bitter medicine and then stood with my hands propped on the counter, my head hanging as my airways relaxed. I looked up to find the officer studying me with those sharp eyes of hers. She took a step toward me.
"Look, I've seen some weird things in my life, but never anything like what's out there. I have to ask, what in God's name happened here tonight?"
I stared at her, confused, and her eyebrows went up.
"You don't know?" she asked.
I was moving toward the front foyer before she could stop me. The door stood wide open, allowing the cops and EMTs to come and go. I slipped out onto the front porch and had to grip the wrought iron railing to hold myself upright as I took in the sight of the land surrounding the house. It was a clear night, the moon high and luminous, allowing me to see enough so I understood immediately what the female officer had meant when she said she'd never seen anything like what was out there. It was dead. The lawn. The bushes that used to stand like sentinels around the house. Mom's lush, unruly garden. The bullet-shaped evergreen trees. Everything that had been living within 100 feet of our house appeared to have been scorched.
"Kenna!"
I heard my name shouted from across the barren land. A cop in uniform was busy cordoning off our yard with yellow police tape, but I spotted Blake and his parents on the other side of the perimeter, talking to another officer. Blake waved his arms at me. I remembered kissing Blake and thinking I wanted to keep going until the sun came up. What if we'd ignored the cry in the night and just kept on kissing? My family would be dead, and Thomas Dunn would still be waiting for me to come home so he could get his revenge. My feet found their way down the porch steps. The soles of my shoes crunched on the dead grass. It sounded as though I were walking on ice chips. Behind me, the female cop called my name, told me to come back to the house, but I ignored her command. I began to run through the dead world. It looked like what was left after a nuclear bomb had been dropped, after everything burned and then went cold. When I reached Blake, he climbed over the police tape, ignoring the cop who kept telling him not to. I threw myself into his arms, and he held me so tight I couldn't breathe. The female cop caught up to me and insisted I come back inside, that she needed to collect my clothes as evidence. My clothes, covered in blood. Evidence of what? I wondered. The perpetrator of this particular crime was dead and gone. There was no one to catch. I ignored her and clung to Blake. Over his shoulder, on the barren side of the yellow tape, I caught sight of a scattering of tawny mounds that looked like piles of dirt in among the blackened trees. Fresh graves. It took me a moment to realize what they really were. Deer. A herd of dead deer. There had to be 20 of them. I squeezed my eyes shut and felt the energy contained under Blake's skin. I wanted to reach inside him and take a little, just enough to make my hunger go away. I released him quickly and stepped back.
"What is it?"
he said, his eyes wide with fear as he took in the blood soaking my clothes.
"Are you hurt? Is your family, are they okay?"
"They're alive," I told him. We're okay." But that wasn't true. I, for one, was definitely not okay. Circle of Death.
"It's simply not possible," Dr. Wong, the senior emergency care physician, announced to me in his private office at the hospital. It was 6 a.m., 4 hours that felt like 4 years had passed since I'd kissed Blake in the woods. Woods that were now dead, along with every shred of life they'd accommodated. Fallen squirrels and birds littered the ground around the trees, as though they'd made some kind of spontaneous suicide pact. Rabbits, foxes, deer, even a bobcat had been found within the circle of death, their bodies stiff and desiccated. If you looked closely, you could see a powdering of tiny, lifeless insects on every surface, and larger ones, crickets and grasshoppers, spiders and beetles, and thousands upon thousands of moths mixed in among them. Outside Dr. Wong's window, half a dozen news vans lurked in the parking lot. I didn't plan on leaving the building anytime soon.
"I spoke with the police," Dr. Wong went on. "They estimate there was around 10 liters of blood in your basement, which supposedly originated from your mom and sister."
I swallowed hard, but there was a knot in my throat that wouldn't go down, and a low, constant fluttering sound in my ears that was driving me insane. Worse was the empty, cavernous hunger inside me, not in my stomach, but in every fiber of my being, in my teeth, in my eyes, in my fingernails. Worse still was the sensation that I was dying as I sat here, that I was shriveling and shrinking as my body cried out for more. More of whatever I'd given to my mom and Aaron to save their lives.
"The average adult has between 3 and 5 liters of blood in his body."
Dr. Wong spread his hands and allowed me to do the math.
"Your mom and your sister were awake, aware, and walking around when the police arrived. With the amount of blood each of them supposedly lost, that isn't possible."
Supposedly. Dr. Wong liked that word. My jaw was rigid. I could barely move it to make words. "So how do you explain it?"
"I don't," Dr. Wong said, raising an eyebrow.
He was one of those people whose age was impossible to guess. His hair was a solid mass, thick and black, his skin unlined. But he had an adult's BS detector, and he wasn't buying mine.
"There is also the matter of the wounds. In essence, there aren't any, which begs the question, where did all that blood come from? And there is your family's behavior, their enlarged pupils and their tremors. We tested them for drugs, chemicals of some kind, but they were clean."
He took a breath and let it out.
"And finally, there is your sister's condition. Your twin sister, is that right?"
"Yes." A wave of chills swam over me, making my teeth rattle. I had changed clothes before leaving our house. My bloody clothes had been bagged as evidence, but I barely remembered choosing what to wear. I wished I'd brought a sweater, but at the time I'd felt feverish. Now I was freezing, and my skin was starting to crawl. I fought the urge to rake it with my fingernails. Dr. Wong consulted the chart in front of him.
"I remember Aaron. I treated her when your mom brought her in a few years ago,
she'd fallen and broken several bones. I winced as I recalled the incident in fifth grade, the last year Aaron had attended school. Aaron had disobeyed our mom's strict mandate never to use the playground equipment, but she'd gotten tired of sitting on the sidelines with her books, watching the other kids swing and run and have a good time. It was my job to watch her, make sure she never did anything dangerous, and usually I did. But that one day I turned my back for a few minutes, and Aaron ended up with multiple fractures in both tibias after dropping only a foot from the monkey bars and landing normally. Aaron's bones were not meant to withstand that kind of impact, and she'd spent the next few months in double casts and a wheelchair. My mom had been furious with me for not taking better care of her. "She needs you, Kenna," my mom had told me while tears of guilt poured down my face. "You're the strong one. You have to protect her." I braced myself for bad news as I asked, "What about her condition?" The doctor spread his hands in a gesture that implied helplessness, but a ghost of a smile lifted the corners of his mouth.
"I don't understand what happened at your house last night, and maybe I never will. But as far as your sister's afflictions are concerned, she no longer seems to have them. She's perfectly healthy."
I swallowed, and finally the lump in my throat went down. Tears stung the backs of my eyes, and my breath hitched in my throat. I stood, my knees trembling. "Can I see her now?" My mom and Aaron had been relegated to a suite on the third floor, where they would be kept for observation and testing until Dr. Wong had satisfied his curiosity. I exited the elevator and walked quickly to their suite, but froze outside when I heard my mom's voice. I cracked the door open slightly and peered inside. I caught sight of a broad-shouldered man in a suit, blocking the view of my mom. He held a pad of paper and was writing quickly. I guessed he was a detective. I stood still and listened, realizing my mom was giving a statement of what had happened last night. I needed to know what she said so I could repeat it. "We went to bed later than usual," Mom said. "We'd been at a music festival near Portland, watching Kenna perform."
"Kenna is your other daughter," the detective said. "The one who came home later."
"That's right," my mom said. "She was out with her boyfriend."
"Name?" the detective asked.
"Blake Callahan."
"Are they talking about me?"
I whirled to find Blake standing behind me. He looked exhausted and wonderful and worried. I wanted to throw my arms around him and bury my face in his neck. Instead, I took a step back from him and put a finger to my lips to shush him. He nodded and leaned in to listen. "So," Mom continued, "it was after midnight when we went to bed. My guess is Dunn was already in the house waiting for us when we got home. I woke up about an hour later with a gun pressed to my head. He had Aaron. He told me he wouldn't hurt her if I did what he wanted." A choked sob followed. Tears sprang to my eyes, and I had to press both hands over my mouth to hold back a sob of my own. "He lied," my mom said, her voice bitter and cold. "We cooperated with him because he said he wouldn't hurt us if we did. He marched us down to the storage room in the basement, probably because it was farthest from the front door. He didn't want Kenna to hear anything if she came home while he was..." She paused. "While he was in the middle of things."
"What did he do once he had you down there?" the detective asked.
"He was insane," Mom said, not really answering the question. "We knew him, you know. He was our neighbor a long time ago. But after his son died, he lost his mind. We tried to reason with him, but he wouldn't listen. He started screaming at us about Kenna, saying she had killed his son, which is ridiculous. Obviously, he needed someone to blame." I had to hand it to my mom. She was a good liar. I almost believed what she was saying, even though I knew it was bullshit.
"And then he attacked you?" the detective asked,
sounding cagey, like he wasn't sure how to broach this subject.
"I mean, he must have attacked you. Your blood was all over that room."
"Yes," my mom and Aaron said at the same time.
"And then?"
A pause, and then Mom said, "We don't remember."
"What do you mean you don't remember?"
"That's all we can tell you,"
Thomas Dunn attacked us. He had a gun, but he didn't use it. Probably didn't want to alert the neighbors. He used a knife instead. And while he was busy with me, I yelled for Aaron to make a run for it. Her voice cracked and Aaron cut in. "He caught me before I could get out of the basement," she said in a tremulous whisper I could barely make out. "He hit me and broke my glasses and dragged me back to the room. I don't remember anything after that."
"You don't remember Kenna coming home?" "No," my mom said.
"No," Aaron said.
"And you don't know how Thomas Dunn died?"
"No," they repeated.
"Or what happened to the land around your house? No theories, aliens, astrological event, divine intervention?"
"No," my mom said firmly. "We have no idea what happened. We don't know why we're still alive. All we can do is be thankful that we are. I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can tell you, detective."
"Then I hope Kenno can fill in a few blanks. Thanks for your time."
The detective's footsteps moved toward the door. I motioned Blake into the room next door to my family's, which was thankfully empty. Blake and I hid behind the curtain, both of us breathing fast until the footsteps faded. Then Blake looked at me.
"You're shivering."
He took off his jacket and wrapped it around my shoulders. It smelled like him, like brown sugar and cinnamon, honey and cedar. I wished I could press my face to his neck and breathe him in, let him put his arms around me. But I didn't dare let him touch me. The hunger was getting worse, a raw ache, a cavernous emptiness that begged to be filled, withering cells crying to be sated. The papery fluttering in my ears continued, louder now, and my skin prickled like I was being jabbed by 1,000 acid-laced stingers. "You've been through this before," I told myself. "You made it through that time. You can do it again." But that had been different. I'd been locked in a cell alone, not surrounded by people.
"What are you going to tell that detective?" Blake asked. "You can't avoid him forever."
I shook my head. "I don't know," I said. But I understood what Blake was really asking. "What happened to you last night? What did you do? What are you hiding?" "I need to see my family," I said to change the subject. "Alone." Blake nodded, doing his best to hide his disappointment that I wasn't ready to confide in him.
"I'll wait in the hall."
I started to turn away, but Blake caught my hand and pulled me back, holding on tight when I tried to pull away. I gritted my teeth behind closed lips, so he wouldn't know the torture it was to be so close to him, so close to what was inside of him. Life. So much irresistible life.
"You can trust me," he said, holding my gaze. "No matter what you tell me, it stays between us, okay?"
"Okay, I know." I slid my hand from his and breathed again. But even when I'd left him behind, I could still feel the pulsing seduction of the life inside him. And I wanted it. Needed it. In an instant, I went from shivering to sweating. My muscles cramped and my stomach roiled with nausea. It was all I could do to keep from doubling over and retching. I paused at the door to take a few deep breaths, which helped a little. Then I stepped inside. There were two beds in the suite. The curtains that would normally partition the patients had been pushed back, so the room with its peach-colored wallpaper and benign country art on the walls was wide open. I looked from my mom to Aaron. For several seconds, all I could do was stare. Whatever had caused their spasmodic movements had calmed. Both of them shone with health and vitality, their skin porcelain smooth and radiant, which seemed doubly impossible because no one looked that good under fluorescent hospital lighting. My mom's and Aaron's hair fell in melted ice cream waves over their shoulders. Aaron's dishwater blonde hair had always been thin and brittle, but now it was the color of butter and was so thick and satiny I had to wonder for a moment if she was wearing a wig. I stood there for a moment, not sure what to do. I couldn't tear my eyes from my twins. Couldn't stop seeing the bruises that had blackened her face a few hours ago, the swollen lump of her eye, and the blood soaking her pajamas. My sickly, frail twin who once broke both legs dropping a foot from the monkey bars, who was so tiny, so skeletal that Mom had to buy her clothes from the children's department. My sister was transformed as though she'd spent the night in a chrysalis and had been reborn into a new body. A healthy, strong, perfect body. Is it true? I asked her. You're... She beamed at me, her eyes filling with tears, and nodded. So much for not living to see my next birthday. There was a chair next to Aaron's bed. I dropped into it before my watery knees gave out. Aaron had terrible eyesight. When she wasn't wearing her glasses, she tended to squint like a mole. But her glasses were gone, and her eyes were wide open. What do we do now? I asked the room. My mom and Aaron shared a furtive glance. Plead ignorance, my mom said, keeping her voice low in case anyone was listening outside the door. No matter what they ask, we don't remember anything, all right? Kenna, it's especially important that you remain vague. I turned to Aaron and saw her clear, bright eyes fill with tears, and her chin begin to quiver. Do you remember? I asked softly. She licked her lips and swallowed. You brought us back, she whispered. I was outside my body, just sort of drifting. Then I felt this tug, like I was a balloon on a string, and you were the one holding the end. She smiled sadly and wiped her eyes as the tears dripped down her nose. You saved us. You saved me. I wanted to tell her no, she was mistaken. I hadn't saved them. I had damned them. I was the reason Thomas Dunn did what he did. I was the reason they had died in the first place. Then the door opened and the detective stepped inside. He was middle-aged, graying, 20 pounds overweight. His tired eyes pinned me down.
There you are, he said. I'm the detective handling your family's case. I need to take your statement.
Can we do it here? He shook his head.
Just you and me.
He gestured impatiently for me to follow.
It won't take long. Come on, let's talk in the cafeteria. Get some coffee. Your boyfriend can come too, he added with a half-smile,
as though he were trying to be charming. Reluctantly, I stood and followed him, my fever ramping up a few degrees. I wanted to take off Blake's jacket, but it felt like a layer of armor, a protective shell. I curled my hands inside the sleeves. Blake waited in the hallway outside the room, pacing restlessly. When I emerged, he stopped pacing and moved to my side. He tried to take my hand, but I folded my arms and stuck my hands in my armpits.
I'm Detective Speakman, by the way, the detective said.
He held his hand out to me. I ignored it. What do you want to know? I asked. You already have your man, and he's dead. What's left to investigate?
What was left that didn't call for an episode of the X-Files?
He raised his eyebrows at me but lowered his hand, gazing at me with a blank expression.
I just need to get all the facts.
It's happening again. I spent the next hour sitting at a table in the cafeteria, sipping and cringing at incredibly bad coffee, and picking at a stale Danish as I told Detective Speakman the abridged version of my story. Blake backed me up on all the parts for which he'd been present. The rest was mine to alter, since there were no witnesses to contradict my account. Finally, Detective Speakman closed his notebook and stashed it in the inside pocket of his suit coat.
So that's it. You came home. You found your mom and sister wounded, blood everywhere. Thomas Dunn trapped you, and then you fell and blacked out and don't remember anything else.
That's right. Out of the corner of my eye, I could see Blake studying me, trying to decide if I was lying, just like Detective Speakman was doing openly. The detective put his hands face down on the table.
Well, I suppose that's all then.
He pulled a card from his wallet and passed it to me.
If you or your family miraculously remember anything, be sure to give me a call.
We will, I said, and the detective rose to leave. He started walking away from the table and then paused.
One more thing. Thomas Dunn's son, Jason, the one who died 7 years ago. You were the last person to see him alive.
I nodded, trying to keep my expression neutral. Under the table, I clasped my hands together to keep them from shaking. Sweat gathered in my palms, making them slick.
When they found him, his body was desiccated. Looked like all the moisture had been drained out of the tissue, just like his father's after. Well, after whatever you don't remember happened to him. I find that to be a strange coincidence. A very strange coincidence. In my line of work, strange coincidences usually have a connection. I just haven't found it yet.
I tried to swallow, but my throat had gone dry. Maybe it runs in the family, like a genetic disorder.
Maybe so, the detective said. Whatever it is, I'm sure I'll figure it out.
When he was gone, I exhaled and wrapped my arms around myself, bowing over the table and resting my forehead on the surface.
You don't look so good, Blake said.
Now I was both shivering and sweating, and my stomach felt like it was filled with broken shards of glass, jabbing and slicing at my insides.
I'm fine, I said, but I wanted to shred my skin with my fingernails.
The crawling sensation came and went in waves, and I was currently surfing a bad one.
No, you're not, he hissed, low and frustrated. You need to see a doctor.
He stood and took me by the arm, trying to haul me out of my seat. I wrenched violently away.
I told you to never touch me!
The cafeteria went silent, all eyes turned toward us. Blake glanced around nervously, licking his lips, eyes as wide as they would go.
I'm only trying to help, he said. Why won't you let me help you? What's going on?
I couldn't meet his eyes. My control was slipping, and I was afraid, so afraid of what I might do to him if I lost control for even a second.
What the detective said about that kid and his dad dying the same way.
He lowered his voice another octave.
Do you know how it happened? Did you have something to do with it?
You need to leave now, I responded, my voice sounding flat and dead.
I can't explain anything. Please, Blake, just do what I ask this one time and leave me alone.
But Kenna...
I shoved my chair back and stood to face him. I dragged a breath down my throat. It was getting harder to breathe. My lungs were filling up with cement, hardening, and I was shivering so violently it felt like I would make the building shake.
Just go! Leave me alone!
I ran from the cafeteria and didn't look back to see if he was following me. I hoped he wasn't because a part of me hoped he was. That part wanted to get him alone and then let my aching, trembling, rebelling body have what it wanted. The rushing, throbbing, fluttering in my ears was so loud now, it was like standing next to an industrial fan as its blades whacked at the air. I needed to be alone. I needed to be locked away somewhere safe. I needed to get out of this hospital before I did something terrible. But I couldn't think straight. The pain in my guts and the fever chills and the shuddering vibration in my ears drove away all rational thoughts. I wandered. I walked the halls. My vision blurred around the edges and turned gray in the center. The people I passed looked like ghosts, their faces chalky blurs. I kept my head down and tried not to see them because I knew that any of them could fix me. The life inside a single one of them could end my agony. These people were walking bottles of medicine, living, breathing panaceas for my unique affliction. But the medicine I needed came at too steep a cost. I was trapped. Trapped in a body that had become hostile territory, a private war zone, and I was the enemy under attack by my own cells. How long before I had no choice but to surrender and give them what they wanted? I didn't know where I was going. Everything moved past me in a rush, like I was on a high-speed train. Nothing seemed real. I couldn't even feel my feet touching the floor. There was only the clutter of knives in my stomach and the wings in my ears, and the terrible, sucking emptiness that was everywhere. Everything. I blanked out for a while. I wasn't sure how long. When I came back, I was standing next to Aaron's bed. My twin was sleeping, and when I glanced behind me, I saw that my mom was too. I shouldn't be in here, I thought, but I didn't move. I wanted to see my sister, remind myself that even though I was in hell, Even though I was dying, she was alive and healthy for the first time in her life. She was going to live a long, long time, and her life would be beautiful. My brilliant sister would do amazing things. A year ago, Erin almost died. She got a bad cold, and that was all it took. Her body gave up, tried to shut down. Mom and I checked her into the hospital, where she remained for 10 days. On day 7, we were alone, and she said, "I need you to do something for me, Kenna. I need you to say goodbye to me now." I remembered how the blood drained, not only from my face but from my entire body, down into the floor, leaving me as cold as a corpse. "No," I had told her, shaking my head. "No, you have to," she insisted. She told me she was tired of fighting. She tried to convince me it was okay, that she was ready, that this was no life being trapped in this body.